I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Welcome to Radio Times. Cities across the country, including Philadelphia, are in the throes of a gun violence epidemic with homicide rates soaring. Nearby Chester, Pennsylvania, a small city of some 35,000 people, has been experiencing the opposite, a drop in violent crime with homicides cut in half this year compared to last. This was after they instituted something called focused deterrence, which uses a mix of prevention, punishment, and peer pressure aimed at those most at risk for engaging in gun violence. The Chester Partnership for Safe Neighborhoods uses a get-tough approach on crime, paired with the offer of social services like education and job training and trauma counseling. Well, we want to know more about how this is working, how residents are reacting to the program, and frankly, how to foster a positive relationship between at-risk individuals and law enforcement. We have two guests who have joined us. Jean-Pierre Bryce is a Chester Community Resource Consultant with the Chester Partnership for Safe Neighborhoods. And Jean-Pierre Bryce, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm great.
Great. Nice to have you with us. And also with us is Matt Krause. He's Deputy District Attorney for Delaware County. Matt Krause, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks so much for having us. Happy to be here.
Happy to have you both here. Let me just make sure our listeners can join us. Lots of ways you can do it, or actually three ways. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always give us a call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Matt, let me begin with you. Why did you think focused deterrence, which we will get into in more detail, would be an effective approach to Chester's gun violence problem? That's to you, Matt.
So I was fortunate enough to work in the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office before coming here, and I know that the Philadelphia DAO implemented a similar focused deterrence initiative in South Philadelphia in 2013, and they saw, you know, a statistically significant drop. I think it was around 35%. And so, you know, being in the office at that time and seeing, you know, what could be done in these, you know, unfortunately neighborhoods that have been plagued by violence was encouraging. And then when D.A. Stolzheimer's administration reached out and asked if I would be interested in spearheading this, you know, I thought that the size of Chester and the unfortunately the violence in Chester would, you know, would really benefit from the focused deterrence model, where there's as much of an emphasis on resources as there is on, you know, typical and more traditional prosecution.
Is that what makes it unusual, the fact that it does have this approach on things like social services and education and training, and also a focus on, frankly, deterring crime?
I think what makes it maybe not unusual but so unique and effective is its focus on the high-risk individuals. And when we say high-risk individuals, we're referring to people that are, you know, most likely to be shot or to shoot someone themselves. And, you know, traditionally, prosecution is usually, it's obviously a very reactive position after a crime has been committed. But also, the fact of the matter is a lot of the conditions that lead to gun violence are of no fault for those that are involved and those high-risk individuals. So if we can be, you know, reactive in a prosecutorial sense as well as proactive in trying to help young people and high-risk individuals avoid, you know, coming in contact with my office, well, I think that, you know, that seems to be the smartest play. And obviously, when you have statistics nationally as well as locally, that the large majority of all violent crime is committed by a very, very small minority of the population, it makes just, you know, makes sense to focus on that small group that is driving the violence.
And just a quick follow-up, and then I'll get you in on the conversation, Jean-Pierre Bryce, but to you, Matthew Krause, so you know who these people are, what, because they've got a record?
No, it's not necessarily a record. Obviously, you know, if you have somebody that has previously been arrested for violent crime or convicted of violent crime and gun possession, that is an indicator that they are one of those high-risk individuals. But it goes beyond that. There are some individuals in these groups down in Chester specifically that arguably keep their hands clean, so to speak. But they might be calling the shots in any particular neighborhood, you know, determining who, you know, who should be targeted or who should be carrying guns or perhaps, you know, carrying packages or being responsible for certain activities within the group. And so it requires a partnership of community members, intelligence, probation officers, parole officers, local police departments, my office, as well as, excuse me, you know, leaders in the community and the schools to identify those people that are actually driving the violence, because the record doesn't necessarily indicate that they are, and we're not, you know, we're not focusing on people just because they have a record.
I hear you. And that's a lot of stakeholders. To you, Jean-Pierre Bryce, just an overall question. It's been, what, almost a year since this program has been instituted. From your perspective as a Chester resident, how would you say it's going?
I think it's going well. Anything like this takes time. A program coming down from the DA. We're not used to the DA offering us anything. So everyone's looking at, why are they offering us anything? Why do they pick you? You know, are you a part of them? And I try to tell people, you know, I work for social services, right? I don't work for the DA's department. I do listen to Matt when it comes to going to different areas and talking to young men and saying, listen, you know, they might think something is going on, but let me tell you about these social services. So, like I tell Matt all the time, I have to work off emotions, right? Because that's what we're working off of. So love is the first thing I have to give them, right? Then I have to give them consistency. I have to constantly show up and tell them, listen, man, you can change your life. I don't have anything to do with the DA and how they prosecute crimes, right? I'm in the community and I'm a part of the community. So I have to be of that upkeep, right? I have to continually tell people how important they are, how special they are, because a lot of us have never heard that before, right? So that's where I come into play. But I think over the last year, the community understands, and they're coming together, and we're trying to help each other solve these crimes and these murders.
And how would you say, even residents living in Chester, and we were getting some stats, it looks like homicides are down something like 50% since the beginning of the year compared to last year. How is life different for the residents of Chester?
Hope.
That's important.
That's very important. And along with hope, you have love. Right. So if we love each other, if we care about each other, we can bring the stats to zero. I know Matt always says he wants to work himself out of a job. I want to work him out of a job as well. You know what I mean? So being in the community and giving people hope and giving people, you know, chances that they never had before. This has never happened before. Right. You can look at it from, you can be like, oh, well, the DA is prosecuting and sending people to jail. Yeah, right. Those are the people that have done the wrong. If you don't do the wrong, you won't go to jail. If you love yourself, there's no way you're going to hurt anyone else. There's no way you can even think about hurting anyone else. So I have to give that message constantly, 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 constantly. And it's working. I think it's working.
Well, I appreciate that. And I'm frankly very glad to hear that. Matthew Krause, let me go back to you. But there is the other side of this, which does involve your office. It does involve law enforcement. How do you talk to a young person, or how? I mean, there have been some shootings in Chester. It's down pretty dramatically, but there have been shootings. How do you respond to that? How do you deal with that under focused deterrence?
And there are shootings, and even one shooting is too many shootings. But what you do is, what we've told, we had a call-in, which is where we call in, quite literally, members of these groups, and we say, we know who you are. We know the groups, the people that you associate with, and we know the violence you're responsible for in Chester. If you let us, we will help you, and that's where JP comes in. But if you make us, we will stop you. And that is, you know, we're going to pool all our resources, and we're going to focus on, you know, those driving that crime. And that comes for, you know, investigations. That comes in, you know, trying to pull different types of evidence, video evidence, forensic evidence, cell phone evidence, and holding those responsible, because, you know – one of the things in our meeting with, you know, many, many community members is they have faith in the police department. And they have faith in the detectives in my office that we are showing we care about the victims of Chester, the victims of gun violence in Chester. And obviously there's, you know, the direct victims, those who are actually shot, but also the victims on the periphery that witnessed the shooting, that are dealing with post-traumatic stress, that are dealing with the trauma of having a loved one either shot or, God forbid, killed because of gun violence. And, you know, by instilling confidence that we are going to hold the violent people responsible for their actions and accountable for their actions, hopefully, you know, gives them reason to believe that the violent people will ultimately be stopped and there will be justice served for the victim, which hopefully encourages or deters other people to act. And it, in fact, you know, we do have evidence that it has done that to an extent. Obviously, we can't arrest our way out of this problem, nor do we intend to, which is why JP has such an integral role in what we're trying to do. But I certainly think by showing our commitment to securing justice for the victims, we are slowly mending the relationship between the Chester community and our office and the police department as to, you know, what can be done and how we can lift Chester up.
Well, let me pick up on that. And this, of course, is the year, you know, a little bit more than a year after George Floyd. And I wonder just about this issue of relationship, Jean-Pierre Bryce, between residents of this community. And we're talking about these high-risk individuals who have been identified for being at risk for committing crime or even being a victim of the crime. How you build a trust between them and law enforcement?
So I was once a part of their crew. I was once out there in the streets, right? I'm a felon. I serve time upstate. So I understand the relationship between prosecutors and us, right? And I go there and I tell them, listen, you can change your life, right? If you try to, you have to have hope that you can do it. That's number one, right? And then I go there and we're talking. We're just talking, right? I'm not here. I'm not here to prosecute you. I'm not here to say anything. I'm just talking to you. So tell me what troubles you, what bothers you. That caring, that instinctual care that I never received when I was out on the street, right, that I'm giving to them is enough to be like, all right, bro, well, I don't want anything to do with the DA. I don't want the DA to have my name, but what programs you got, right? And then I call, you know, a program up and I say, all right, first thing I want you to do is go to therapy, right? Trauma-informed therapy is key. You know, if you're not talking to someone about how you feel, you hold that in. And then as soon as someone steps on your sneaker, you explode, right? And you can't explode with your words because you don't know how to use them. So you use a gun because that's the loudest thing you have, right? So I talk to them like that. And there are quite a few young men, right, that do not want to be associated with the DA, right? But they'll work with me and stand behind me and be like, nah, bro, you right, right? We can change this. We can change the community. And the fact that the DA has this program and is going this route shows that they care, right? And I get it. It looks crazy. It feels crazy. But if you care about yourself just a little bit, right, things can change in your community. So they understand that. And it's coming together, I think.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. And let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Jean-Pierre Bryce. He is a Chester Community Resource Consultant working with the Chester Partnership for Safe Neighborhoods. Also with us is Matt Krause. He's Deputy District Attorney for Delaware County, talking about this program that's been instituted in Chester, PA, just south of Philadelphia, a city of about 35,000 people. And it is focused on trying to reduce gun violence, the rate of homicide, and so far it is working. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with Matthew Krause, Deputy District Attorney for Delaware County, Jean-Pierre Bryce, a Chester Community Resource Consultant, talking about this program that has been instituted in Chester to address the problem of gun violence. And again, you can join us, Radio Times at WHYY.org, or you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Matt, let me just pick up on something you were saying earlier about focusing essentially on the group, that there are people who are part of this high-risk group who have committed crimes, and then they have people who are sort of associated with them but frankly don't have a crime record yet. What about this kind of guilt by association? Is that something you have to be careful of in instituting a program like this?
Absolutely. I mean, we don't want anyone, just because they live in a certain neighborhood to feel the pressures of what we are doing in our enforcement with Chester Partnership for Safe Neighborhoods. Obviously, a lot of times, no one can control where where they grow up, where they're able to live. So that's why we're very, very careful that when we are, you know, sifting through all the information we have and speaking with everybody and all the partners that we're speaking with, that, you know, we are absolutely sure there is, you know, group involvement. And when I say group, you know, traditionally people might say gangs. There aren't gangs in Chester in the sense that, you know, you kind of see in the media or advertised in the media with, you know, the Latin Kings, the Bloods, the Crips. It's mostly just close-knit neighborhoods that – I mean, and they're very real feuds, but we prefer to call them groups because we think that's a more accurate description of them. But yeah, we make sure that we have verifiable information and confirmed the intelligence that we've gathered when we've identified these high-risk individuals as being group members.
John Pierre-Brace, let me pick up on what you have been telling us. Essentially, you talk with these young people about their lives, about what they want, about what they need. Are you one of the first people to have asked them those particular questions? These are personal questions.
Well, I know I was never asked the questions.
Really?
when I was out in the street, right? So I can only assume that, you know, maybe they didn't hear the person, or maybe it was a church and they don't deal with churches, right? It's different groups in the city, right? And this Chester partnership has knocked down a couple walls and reached out and shook hands. And Matthew Krause and Jason Harmon are doing an excellent job at making these partnerships work, right? So now we're coming together as a group and we're saying, listen, we can help you, right? Now we're not coming at you as a church. I'm not coming to you as a group trying to help you and have to pass you off to someone else. Like, we literally have the doorways to open in, you know, your life, right? So I definitely appreciate them, right? I tell them every day. So for us to be out here in the community, I need to know that, you know, there's a job training program behind me that I could send them to that's ready to take them, right? I need to know that there's a GED so you can get to the job training. And I tell them, man, it's hard work. You have to be willing to put the hard work in. Yeah, we can be out here and play every day. And it's fun. Literally, it's fun to be out there running from the cops. It gets your adrenaline going. But when you get tired, like I got tired when I came home, I was tired. I can't do this again. I can't leave my family again. So I had to change my life. I had to, but there was no one there to push me. I had to push myself. And a lot of us, we get to that point where there's no sense in pushing. There's no hope. And you got a 41-year-old man still out there doing the same thing he was doing at 21. And 17. And it's like, that's sad. So, you know, for him, I can't get him in a program, but I can help him the way I help myself and call him every day and talk to him like, bro, you good? You straight? You go to that job interview? You feel me? You need a tie? You need a suit? Let's go try to find you a suit, something to wear, right? Something to feel good about yourself. You need help with your resume? I got somebody that can help you with that, right? So that's what I'm here for, right? I'm a resource inside of a resource. And I just want to serve my community.
I really am happy to hear that. Let me turn to you, Matthew Krause. As you mentioned, this was a program that was tried in South Philadelphia almost 10 years ago. I remember actually doing a program about it when it was first started. It was not sustained. And my understanding from doing some reading about it is that it was more focused on the sort of law enforcement part and less focused, or in the end sort of gave up on the social service part. What's going to sustain this in Chester?
I think it's making sure you emphasize you can't have one without the other. Obviously, you know, providing the resources is so important, and something that's not – hasn't been really done, at least in Delaware County, before through our office, through the district attorney's office and the Chester Partnership from Safe Neighborhoods. But at the same time, if there are no consequences to actions, if there are no consequences to the person that picks up that gun and shoots another person – well, then there isn't going to be any concern for, you know, it's an easy choice to make. You know, if you have to make a choice between picking up the gun or not picking up the gun, if there aren't going to be any consequences for those actions, of course you're going to pick up the gun again. And so I think making sure that we don't lose sight of either prong of this initiative, and we put the appropriate emphasis on both the resources and being proactive, as well as being reactive when we need to be reactive in terms of, you know, getting justice for victims and holding those, you know, those individuals responsible for the violent crimes they've committed. I think that's where, you know, we need to remain laser focused so we can continue to see success and hopefully, you know, as JP says, work ourselves out of a job.
Hmm. And to you jump here, Bryce, speaking of guns, how easy is it to get a gun in Chester, Pennsylvania?
It's easy. You can make your own gun. They have ghost guns. You can order it online, right? You don't have to find a person anymore, right? And there are just guns everywhere, right? And literally, you have to carry a gun to be protected from a person with a gun. So if I don't have a license and I get caught with the gun, I'm arrested, right? So and if he pulls out a gun and I have a gun and I shoot, that's self-defense for me. But, you know, it's different ways for the law. And that's why I said Matthew handles the law and I handle the streets. And I'm trying to get people to understand, don't pull that gun out, right? Don't even carry the gun. Or go get your license to carry the gun. And if you can't get your license because you have felonies, let's work on being a productive citizen so you can get a pardon and you can probably get your gun license. There are doors that are opening up in our community that have never been opened before, and we can't be scared to walk through them.
How do you disarm people, to you, Matthew Krause? Picking up on Jean-Pierre Bryce was just saying.
I mean, it's a long process, and there's no way we're going to be able to fix the comfort that some of these high-risk individuals have found in guns. As JP said, it's a very real concern. If I don't have a concern, or if I don't have a gun, and you know, and the opposition has a gun, then you know, I'm the one that's, you know, most at risk, you know. But seeing that, you know, they're equally at risk just by carrying the gun with the consequences that they could face if they're not allowed to have one. And then, as JP said, realizing that, you know, it's not, you know, either you pick up the gun or you don't pick up the gun. It's you can do something that has nothing to do with a gun in terms of bettering yourselves, bettering your family, and we want to help you get there. And I don't think, you know, too often they see it as a kill or be killed scenario. But if we can open up another door, build another door for them to go through and help them walk through it, as JP said, that's what we have to do. And that's what's going to take time. And that's what we're going to continue to fight for, to make sure we provide and build those doors for everyone that wants to walk through them.
To you, Jean-Pierre, and just talking about the rest of the community in Chester, most people in Chester do not commit crimes. You know, they have families, they go to work, they have jobs, they care about their community. How has this program affected their lives?
I think it's affected their lives because it's calling for people to be involved. It's calling for people to care. Listen, most of the kids that are committing these crimes literally have probably never had anyone care about them really in life. Right. So they go to the gang. They hang out with their homies. They go to the store. The homie buys them a pair of sneakers when he needs it. So when he tells me he's in trouble and he needs me to go shoot at somebody, I'm ready. You know what I mean? So that hope, that love that we have to give each other, and we're trying in the community. Accountability. Right. Accountability first to the community. Accountability to the police department. Accountability to the DA. And if we get that all in cohesion, I think we'll be fine. But it's going to take a while because people are used to what they're used to. And when they see me come up, they're like, oh, man, here he comes. And it's like, nah, bro, I'm here because I care about you. If you don't want me to be here, just let me know. He's like, nah, you good. Come talk to me. Right. And that right there is enough to keep me going. I'm out there by myself. Right. So literally, I have to make sure you okay with me coming over here and talking to you. Yeah. You good? Like, come on. All right. I don't want to think that I can just walk up on any block in the city and say, yo, this is what we have. I have to ask permission first. And that's respect. So I give them respect and they give me respect back.
We have to leave it there. And I really appreciate both of you joining us today on Radio Times. Jean-Pierre Bryce, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And thanks for the work you're doing. He's a Chester Community Resource Consultant with the Chester Partnership for Safe Neighborhoods. And to you, Matthew Krause, thank you for joining us on Radio Times as well.
Of course. Thanks, as always.
You're welcome. And he's Deputy District Attorney for Delaware County. Well, we've been talking about something called focus deterrence, how it is being applied in Chester, Pennsylvania. That's a small city just outside of Philadelphia. So far this year, there's been a drop in violent crime, including shootings in Chester, making it an outlier compared to a lot of other urban areas, including Philadelphia. Focus deterrence, as the name suggests, focuses on a small number of people responsible for most of the gun crime in the city, using a get tough approach with the offer of social services and peer pressure. It's been tried in other cities, including Philadelphia, with mixed results. Joining us is Thomas Apt, and he's senior fellow at the Council on Criminal Justice, author of a book called Bleeding Out, The Devastating Consequences of Urban Violence and a Bold New Plan for Peace on the Streets. And Thomas Apt, joining us by Skype. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Pleasure to be with you.
Let me ask you first, before we get into focused deterrence, about how you see this explosion of violence that we're seeing in many cities, including Philadelphia. And I'm thinking about gun violence in particular. It's pretty shocking and quite disturbing to see what's happening. And then we'll talk about Chester and also talk about focused deterrence. But what do you think explains this rise in gun violence?
Sure. Thank you for the question, Marty. You know, on Monday, the FBI is going to release the crime statistics for 2020. And unfortunately, the headline will be a 30% increase in homicides nationwide. There's never been an increase like that. It's the largest increase on record. And while we're still nowhere near the highest of the highs in the late 80s and early 90s, it's a really sharp change in the wrong direction. Here's what we know about that rise in homicide. First, as you said, unfortunately, it is driven by community gun violence, meaning gun violence that's happening in community settings and driven by, you know, dispute and retaliatory violence, usually between young men without a lot of options and without much hope. And we know that this is happening nationwide. It's not just in Philadelphia. It's all around the country. Almost every city is experiencing some type of violence. We also know that this is happening here in the United States, but not all around the world. And so that this is, unfortunately, somewhat of a uniquely American phenomenon, as are sort of chronic high rates of gun violence. And so the question is what's happening? And since this is a national effect, you have to look to national factors. And I think the two biggest factors are the pandemic and the social unrest following the brutal murder of George Floyd.
Wow.
And what we see is that the pandemic has a very complicated effect on crime. It suppresses some forms of crime, like property and drug crime. But it appears to be having an aggravating effect on gun violence, likely by placing the individuals who are already at high risk for gun violence under tremendous strain and pressure and isolating them even further than they were before. The social unrest following the murder of George Floyd likely had an impact in one of two ways or both. There is the much discussed depolicing effect, where in response to the pandemic and protests and lots of other things, police have reduced sort of discretionary enforcement activities and really just sticking to the sort of reactive policing that they have to do. Then there's the sort of more subtle but also important delegitimizing effect, which is that when communities that have been historically discriminated against by the police witness a national incident like the murder of George Floyd, it sends a signal to them, a deeply discouraging signal that causes them to withdraw even further. And that means less calls to 911, less cooperative witnesses, less jurors willing to serve. And ultimately what it means is that the traditional function of law enforcement, perhaps the oldest function of law enforcement, which is the nonviolent resolution of disputes, is made even harder, and that causes violence to rise.
Well, let me pick up on several things, and I do want to make sure that we do focus on focused deterrence, frankly, because I think everything that you described there makes, frankly, a lot of sense. we have this outlier. It's in our Philadelphia area. It's Chester, PA. They have instituted this focused deterrence program. It's in its infancy, but they have seen a reduction of gun violence in the rate of homicide. So that looks promising. And I think, you know, sustaining it, of course, is one of the many challenges. But help us understand sort of what the thinking behind it is. The idea that there are probably a small number of people responsible for most of the crime, that there are hot spots in neighborhoods where that seems like there's a kind of a congregation of criminal activity. Help us understand what's going on there.
Sure. So all around the country and even all around the world, gun violence is sticky. And what I mean by sticky is that it clusters together in a surprisingly small number of people and places. It's not evenly distributed, and it's not even modestly concentrated. It's hyper-concentrated, which means that if you focus on the highest risk people and places, you can have significant results. And the research, over 30 years of rigorous social scientific research, says that sticky solutions, not surprisingly, seem to work best. And focused deterrence is one of those sticky solutions. It focuses on a very specific behavior, shootings, and very specific people, the individuals and groups that are at the highest risk for those shootings.
And we have about a minute before our break here. But so the one part of it is really a kind of get tough on these people. And the other part is, here are some social services. Here are some things that we can do to help you if you can, stay away from guns?
Yes. So, you know, it's a classic sort of carrot and stick type of approach. There's an element of accountability, which is a clear message that the shooting has to stop. And if it doesn't stop, you will be held accountable. But there's also a clear message of empathy, which is, if you're willing to change this deadly behavior, we want you back in this community and we will support you.
Let's take that short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Thomas Apt. He's senior fellow at the Council on Criminal Justice, wrote a book called Bleeding Out, The Devastating Consequences of Urban Violence and a New Bold Plan for Peace on the Streets, something I think we're all looking for. And we're talking about something called focused deterrence. It's been used here in Philadelphia, I have to say, with some mixed results. It's being used in Chester, PA, just outside of Philadelphia. And again, you can join our conversation. Any questions or comments, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can pick up the phone and give us a call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here, Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, talking with Thomas Apt about what can be done to reduce the level of gun violence in this country. And there are some programs that have shown some promise. I was talking before you joined us with a community resident from Chester, a man who had served some time. He's now back working with young people on the streets of Chester. And his approach was trust and talk to me and tell me, you know, who you are and what you have been through. We've done so many programs about young people at risk here in the Philadelphia area. And one of the phrases that really stuck with me over time, which is hurt people hurt people. And I wonder how much we need to understand that to understand how something like focused deterrence can work.
I think that's absolutely right. Hurt people do hurt people. You know, many of the young men living in our neighborhoods that suffer from concentrated poverty have rates of PTSD that are higher than returning veterans from Iraq or Afghanistan. And so that trauma directly impacts their behavior. It makes them, in the sort of medical terminology, hypervigilant, which is a fancy way of saying very quick to respond, very quick to anger. And we need to diffuse that. And part of the way we do that is by treating that trauma.
In fact, you say that cognitive behavioral therapy has shown to be effective. Help us understand that.
Sure. I think there's a lot of sort of easy talk around gun violence, and people, it's very convenient to say, well, what we need to do is just get these guys more jobs, better school, quicker housing, et cetera, et cetera. But the fact of the matter is if you can't treat the trauma that these young men, and they're not all young men, some are older, have been through, then it's very hard for those other strategies to be successful. And so one of the key things that we've learned is that most of the successful behavior change strategies that address trauma, among other things, involve some component of cognitive behavioral therapy, or CBT. It's often CBT in combination with subsidized employment, CBT in combination with sports, CBT in combination with other things. But unless you've got that sort of intensive clinical approach, for the young men at the highest risk of violence, nothing else seems to work.
And this is talk therapy. I mean, it has a kind of focus, very behaviorally based focus, but it's talk therapy.
It's highly structured talk therapy, but yes.
What about, I mean, one of the arguments is, well, let's not just get guns off the street. But, you know, if we got guns off the street, then we wouldn't have a gun violence problem. Are you saying with this, which is that's never going to happen, so we have to figure out how to live with guns?
No, I think that we have a long-term challenge in the United States, which is that, you know, broadly speaking, all of the evidence that we have suggests that the more guns are in circulation, the more gun deaths you will have, be it suicides, homicides, accidents, or anything. But that's a multi-generational struggle, and we have to continue that struggle. But yes, in the near term, you know, for this year, for the next 3 years, for the next 5 years, we have to take the number of guns that are out there essentially as fixed. And so we need strategies that don't depend on, you know, massively reducing the supply of guns in the United States. That doesn't mean we shouldn't focus on illegal gun carrying.
Right.
That's a different thing. But it does mean that, you know, how many gun sales happen broadly in the United States is not going to affect what happens on the streets of Philadelphia day to day.
Philadelphia has tried focused deterrence. Other cities have as well. And using Philadelphia as example, this was in South Philadelphia almost 10 years ago. It worked for a while, and then it kind of frittered away. Why, if something is successful, at least initially, why isn't there more sustained support for something like this?
Sure. Well, first of all, no program is a panacea, and even focused deterrence doesn't work every time. There's a systematic review of all those rigorous research around focused deterrence, and of 24 tests of the strategy, it succeeded 19 times. That's pretty good,
right.
But it's not. But it's by no means a guarantee of success. And I think it really raises the broader question, which is, it's not the case that we don't know how to reduce gun violence. We do know how to do it, and we've done it time and time again. But the question is, your question, which is, why can't we sustain it? And I think that the issue is that we keep lurching from crisis to crisis. And when gun violence spikes to a certain level, then it becomes a broader issue that people outside of communities, poor communities, care about. But if it remains at a certain level, then it's really just an issue for poor people. And unfortunately, unfortunately, that means that there's not the political will to address it.
Because people don't care.
Because people don't care.
I wonder, too, with focused deterrence, because it does have what we would think of as a sort of conservative approach, which is, you know, getting tough with crime and with certainly with violent criminals. But it also has this more liberal progressive approach, which has to do with therapy and education and some of these sort of softer sciences. Is that part of its maybe success, but also its problem?
I think that's exactly right. And it's true of most of the evidence-based approaches to gun violence reduction. They don't really line up with the political talking points of either political party. They're not entirely hard They're not entirely soft. And that means that it's often hard to explain to a politician's constituent. But unfortunately, that is what seems to work, this sort of sensible center on strategies. And if you just look at, you know, how people respond to incentives, any parent knows that you don't raise a child exclusively on punishments or exclusively on rewards. You maximize behavior change by selectively using both. Adults are no different and criminals are no different than other adults. And so we need things to say yes to and things to say no to, even if that's not what is most convenient politically.
Let me pick up on something you were saying earlier, and this was describing why we see this spike in violent crime, especially gun crime, in the last year or so, related to the pandemic, but also, you said, related to the uprising in response to the death of George Floyd. Using that last one, and if this is really about the community and community policing, how do we mend some of that rift between the community and the police and law enforcement?
I think that's a really important question, and I think I think there's a national conversation going on there. I think the first thing that you have to do is you have to get better outcomes, which means we have to have less use of excessive force, less use of unnecessary stops and seizures. And so, you know, the way to gain trust is to earn it, not just by having a big kumbaya conversation, but by actually improving outcomes, particularly for impacted communities, particularly for poor people of color. But the next thing, I think, is to understand that we're either going to solve this all together or not at all. And that ultimately there needs to be a reconciliation between police and communities. And sometimes I worry that some of the language on both sides is either delaying or preventing entirely that reconciliation from happening. I think it's very important to talk about police accountability and how to improve that, but I also think it can be counterproductive to talk about abolishing or defunding the police entirely.
Let me read a comment from Mike. He says, since poverty is the core of the problem, let's go after that with job training. Job skills are the long-term key to the solution. Do you agree?
I agree that poverty is closely connected to violence, but I don't agree that it's a short-term solution. We need to be addressing poverty in America for a wide variety of reasons, but that is simply not an effective strategy in the short run. So same thing with guns. Same thing with jobs, same thing with education. Over the next 3 to 5 years, you need to treat all of those as fixed, and you need to focus, as I said, on the highest risk individuals and the highest risk places.
Finish your thought. Sorry about that. Go ahead.
I just need to emphasize that. The evidence says that in the short term, nothing else works. You have to focus on these highest risk individuals. You have to go right at the problem.
In fact, you have said that violence creates poverty, and growing up in and under violence then disadvantages a student. And if you don't get a good education, it's hard to get a good job, and thus it becomes a perpetual thing. Can you expand on that?
Sure. That's exactly right. So while poverty leads to violence, violence also perpetuates poverty. And unfortunately, the biggest impact of chronic exposure to violence is on poor children. And there's a lot of good research by Raj Chetty at Harvard and Pat Sharkey at Princeton that shows that exposure to violence may be the single biggest factor that keeps poor kids poor, that reduces their income mobility over time. And the reason is because if poor kids' minds are absorbed with thinking about and reliving trauma, it makes it harder for them to perform in school. And if they can't perform in school, it ultimately limits their life chances.
We've been talking about sort of component parts of focused deterrence, but you've also said that it's important to have people who care deeply about these children in their lives, and that women often play this role. And, you know, sadly, women who have lost children to gun violence have a special cachet that I think other people don't have. Can you expand on that?
Sure. I think that anyone who has experienced the devastating loss of a family member who died due to gun violence, has a certain moral authority. And again and again, we have seen family members, not just women, but especially women, really deploy that moral authority as best they can to try to stop this tide of gun violence and try to make sure that this doesn't happen to other people. And in focused deterrence, those family members, often women, are a key voice. And they're a key voice that says to these individuals and groups that are involved in gun violence, I don't want what happened to my son to happen to you.
That you become the victim.
Yes. We don't want you to be the next victim. And it's very important to understand that the perpetrators of gun violence are oftentimes also the victims. It's a cycle. They're caught up in a cycle of retaliation. They're all, and so, you know, many of the people who are doing the shooting have been shot before, have lost family members, have lost friends and acquaintances. And so it takes a lot to interrupt this this cycle, but it can be done with the right blend of accountability and empathy. And
you go ahead.
And again, it's not all one thing. It's not all tough on crime law enforcement, and it's not all soft on crime supports and services. It has to be both.
So, do we need more and different laws? Do we need more spending?
You know, these programs can make a big difference with a relatively small investment. Although they've been chronically underinvested over the past few years. In my book, I proposed what I thought was a pretty ambitious approach, almost $1 billion approach nationwide in the 40 most dangerous cities. But I'm very pleased that President Joe Biden has a plan that that if the reconciliation bill passes, will include $5 billion for community-based violence intervention programs. So I think that if that passes, help may be on the way, and we may have the funding necessary.
Let me read a comment from Margaret. Please stop ignoring the racial aspect of policing. Police enforce the societal norms. In this society, they maintain supremacy and disadvantage others by methods of policing. Do you agree with that?
I agree that there's racism in policing and that it needs to be addressed. But I don't agree, and I think it's a big problem to say, that we can't stop the murders of young men of color until all racism is eliminated from policing. That's going to take decades. And so we cannot hold this conversation hostage to every other conversation. We have to be able to do two things at once.
Almost out of time, and I was watching your TED Talk, and there you summarize things, and we've been talking about some of them: focused deterrence, hotspot policing. You talk about environmental design, how important that is, violence interrupters. I'm also thinking about, you know, after school programs. We often learn that children, they just frankly don't have, you know, basketball courts with actual functioning baskets, you know, for their to play. Just expand on that if you could.
Sure. I don't think those are very effective. And the reason is because the highest risk individuals are not in school. And so school-based programs, while they're important as a sort of preventative measure, and they're good for a host of other reasons, are not going to have a big impact on violence. Most individuals who are involved in gun violence are 18 to 34, and the ones that are younger than that are certainly not in school.
Well, we have to leave it there. Thomas App, thank you for joining us today in Radio Times.
It's been my pleasure.
And our pleasure as well. His book is called Bleeding Out: The Devastating Consequences of Urban Violence and a Bold New Plan for Peace in the Streets. He's also a senior fellow at the Council on Criminal Justice. Go to WHYY.org and look for Radio Times under Programs. You can also download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. And you can always check out the rebroadcast of Radio Times. It airs weeknights at 11 o'clock right here on WHYY. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of the show. Radio Times is produced by Debbie Builder and Paige Murray-Bessler. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you for joining us.